Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy
on Seattle Sports Station.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union. Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Now, I don't mean to frame this in like a negative way, Jake, but the Mariners did avoid a sweep yesterday, and somehow, despite Paul Sewald said not to call it a slump. Despite underperforming on offense, there's still 3-3.
There we go. There we go. It's not a slump.
It's not a slump.
It's just a current
performance
lapse of
offense. It's not a slump. It is an absence of offense. It is mm-hmm. an absence of ideal play. Is what it is.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. I like that a lot better.
Thank you so much.
Maybe he would have. You know,
that's what I tell my boss. That's what I'll tell Kyle when I'm late. I'm not late. I had an extended absence.
That's right.
Before my arrival.
That's right. It's just, you know, it's all, you know, how you phrase it, right?
Right. I had an absence of presence.
But it is great to see that they were able to, you know, finish off the series with the Blue Jays with a win and to be able to do it in a convincing fashion, right? And you look at it from the way that Marco Gonzalez pitched, and we're going to get into that very heavily here today and at the start of the show, but also that the bats came alive. Hey, when you get contribution from your best players, a la Ty France and him having a monster two-run shot in the game, having, you know, guys at the bottom of your lineup contribute in Cal Raleigh, good things happen. And it was great to see that. And man, they needed it in the worst way because this Blue Jays series was not a fun series overall for the Mariners.
No, it absolutely wasn't. In fact, as exciting and thrilling as the Mets series, particularly the Mets finale, was, what were we talking about a couple days ago? How all of that momentum felt like it kind of died with mm-hmm. a really lackluster performance, especially against a former Mariner, against Yusei Kikuchi. It was horrible. They looked inept. It looked like an offense where you were like, none of this makes sense. I mean, I wasn't expecting you to be built like a World Series team, but you were built to have better offense than you're having, and they've gotten into the swing of that. Jerry Dipoto, by the way, has a theory about, you know, kind of the trend on the Mariners offense, and not just why we haven't seen it, but what he thinks will happen with the offense. We're going to get to that in about 25 minutes. He was on with Mike Salk this morning, but I want to start by talking about Marco Gonzalez. Marco Gonzalez, by the way, has been accused of maybe not being so sexy.
Really?
No, Marco's not.
Yeah.
No, Marco's not sexy. You know, he doesn't throw 95.
We talk.
I mean,
that's
yeah.
On a tee.
On you know, baseball, everything today's about velocity. You know, and everybody gets excited when Mooney's out there throwing 99, and Logan, you know, almost hits 100 last night. You know, there's a lot of different ways to get people out, and Marco takes pride in what he does. When he steps on the mound, he feels like he can throw 100. But he locates, he changes speeds, and he wins. You know, there's a lot to be said for that.
Saying when he steps on the mound, he feels like he can throw 100 is such accidental shade from Scott Servais. It reminds me of when, I know it's a little bit different, but Pete Carroll on the Pete Carroll show one day was talking about Al Woods recovering a fumble, and he was like, I'm sure he thought he could get a touchdown.
in his head.
I'm sure he thought he could return it.
Right.
He slips and falls after like 5 yards.
Well, you know, but in all honesty, it's all about how you pair your stuff. And, you know, Mike Blowers was talking about it a bunch in the broadcast yesterday, is that when Marco Gonzalez really does have that changeup that he's so good at using, and then he's able to come up on the, you know, right-handed hitters and go up to the top of the zone in the corner with his 89-mile-an-hour fastball, it does have more jump to it. But I think that, you know, these are inside jokes that are being played before us, right? Our show has a lot of inside jokes. And
like
if you're not a part of them, and you're listening for the first time, you might feel left out, which is why you should probably listen every single day so
yes.
you don't lose out on the conversation.
God forbid you miss out on our inside jokes about Troy Aikman.
That's right. But you have to know that this is probably a conversation that has been going on within the clubhouse, and in terms of, you know, joking and jest with Marco, and also probably the chip on Marco Gonzalez's shoulder. There are lots of athletes that carry chips on their shoulder, and we've seen them here in Seattle, right? Marco Gonzalez reminds me of Doug Baldwin in a lot of ways. Just at all times, just has a giant chip on his shoulder in regards to, you know, his performances, in regards to, you know, maybe lack of appreciation for what they do and how good they do their job. But I think that, you know, for Marco, he has not had a clean start to this season. And he did not have a good start to the season last year, right? And you're wondering what's going on with Marco, because, you know, one of his staples is that he's consistent. That's what he has made his game off of, is that he is going to be a consistent battler every single time he steps out on the mound. Now, I think one of the things that's so important to notice is that in this series, in this road trip, I should say, Marco Gonzalez is taking a turn. Marco Gonzalez has had two amazing outings against
opposite aces.
Yes, exactly. Opposite aces in Kevin Gausman and Max Scherzer, and has gotten the better of both of them. That is a huge development for this team, and I don't care if you think his stuff is sexy or not. I mean, that is the type of outings that you expect from Marco Gonzalez and need from Marco Gonzalez if this team is going to continue to have a chance at making a run late into this season.
To his credit, here's what Marco had to say about accusations that his stuff just isn't that sexy. Marco said, well, my wife thinks I'm sexy. So he tweeted that out as a response.
Gotcha.
So,
well, yeah. I mean, that's a pretty good response. I mean, you know, look, as long as your wife thinks that, that's all that matters. And hold that confidence. I think for Marco, this is something also that when I saw, you know, his responses to, you know, the media and talking through some things, it just, you know, like I said, that giant chip that is on his shoulder, it will never leave. It will never leave him. And I appreciate that about Marco Gonzalez, but here's what it also leaves him to, right? You know, he said, look, I don't even touch 90, but I don't know what else I can say. I'm still here. I'm still making big league starts and still getting big league hitters out. So I guess that speaks for itself. And it does. It does. When you do that. And when Marco Gonzalez is feeling confident and feeling good in his stuff and has great control,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he is a very, very valuable player to have on your rotation. And I just think that there's two different contrasting pitchers that you see with Marco. And it's a matter of, can you get Marco into a rhythm, get him confident, and get him feeling in that groove? Because once he does, Stacey, that is a problem for the rest of the American League, and it's a great problem. It's a great thing happening for the Mariners. Let me give you some splits here. Okay, in the first half of the season last year, he was in 11 games. He was 1-5. ERA was nearly touching 6. And then after his in the second half, and he had this amazing start in against the Yankees on the road last year, he then just totally dialed it in, and he was one of the best pitchers in the AL. In 14 games in the second half of the season, he was 9-1. He had a 2.7 ERA, and this team really took off. Now, I'm not saying Marco Gonzalez is the complete catalyst for this team. As Marco goes, the team goes,
mm-hmm.
but certainly it helps, and it's a major factor for this team to be able to have Marco Gonzalez, you know, pitching at a high level. And in the last two games, he's had a 1.42 ERA. And he's 1-0. So it's great to see Marco get on great footing here, and hopefully that he can continue to be this type of guy throughout the season.
Also, like yesterday, you and I talked about a hypothetical, and listeners were chiming in with their opinions, and we were saying, look, you have to choose one. It's the point of the hypothetical, right? Neither of these are ideal, but would you rather have great pitching and struggling offense, or great offense and struggling pitching? And the answers were very mixed from listeners, and you and I were like, well, I guess in theory I'd rather have great pitching, because you feel like the offense could maybe adapt and change or be adjusted in a way that is a little trickier to adjust a poor pitching staff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is harder to add an ace than it is to try to add some kind of bat near the bottom of your lineup.
Yeah.
Now, you said, well, Mike Trout would beg to differ. Mike Trout would say, well, wait a minute.
yes.
You know, having great offense, it might be fun in theory, but, you know, having a poor pitching staff will keep you out of the playoffs no matter what. Plenty of Mariners fans were chiming in saying, well, Felix would like a word and like to let you know that having a Cy Young winner sometimes isn't enough. However, I think what we saw, you know, was funny us having that conversation prior to this game, because I think what we saw is what happens when the pitching continues to stay really solid. Your third consecutive start Great start by a pitcher.
Correct.
This time the bats picked up. And I think what you saw this time was one of the more complete games we've seen from Seattle. And you've seen what it looks like when you can get not, you know, they got 10 hits, which is a great day on offense, but not even their best offensive day of the season so far. But when those bats heat up, how complete this team can look.
No doubt. No doubt. And that's the biggest aspect of this is if the starting pitching can stay where it's at right now, and they can continue to keep battling and keep you in games, this offense is going to turn around enough. It may not be one of the very best offenses in all of baseball, but it should be enough if your starting rotation can deliver on outings like they have over the last three starts. And if they can be consistent like that, then you're going to be able to deliver. And there's too much talent on this lineup for them to not take a turn, a genuine turn at some point in time. And that's what you're waiting for. You're waiting for this team to collectively click. And I would rather be waiting on the lineup that I know is talented versus knowing that I've got a shaky starting rotation that I have zero faith in. And so right now, the Mariners, you know, you look at it and, you know, what did we talk about on this road trip? We talked about, gosh, if they could just get to 500, if they could get 500 through this road trip, that would be a major win for them. Well, right now, Stacey, where are they at?
500.
They're 500. They're 3-3. It may not feel that way because of this recent series and the lack of production.
It doesn't feel that way. But yesterday, when they were like 3-3 heading into the Red Sox, I was thinking if they were to leave this very tough road trip at 500, I'd think, oh, it's a solid road trip.
Yes, 100%. That's all you could ask for. But to Paul Sewald's point, right? We get caught up in the emotion. Media, fans, everything else. You get caught up in the emotion. And it's easy to do so, right? But good teams and great teams, and this is, I think, to more of what Paul Sewald was speaking to, is that you can't get caught up in the day-to-day emotion, especially over the course of a 162-game season. You got to continue. As long as you, as a team, I think the most important thing, as long as you as a team continue to keep believing in your process, continue to keep believing in your adjustments that you're making, continue to keep believing and having confidence that everyone around you is going to step up and eventually you can take the next turn, that's what matters. And that's what good teams are able to do. They're able to weather the storm that they're currently in and be able to come out on the other side in a very positive way. And so right now we're all waiting for that to happen. And we're all, as fans and media members, just anxiously awaiting to see that. But I think that is kind of what Sewald is saying is like, look, we're 3-3. And it may not be in the fashion that you want it to be, but it's still 3-3, and we're putting ourselves in a good position heading into this last series against the Red Sox, a four-game series against the Red Sox, to potentially walk out on a winning record. And that is all you could ask for from this organization right now, to put themselves in a good position as they're going into, you know, coming back home, heading into the final couple weeks of May, and hopefully that's when things start to really start moving forward for him.
Speaking of things moving forward, Jerry Dipoto explained why he thinks that'll happen. That's coming up in 15 before we get to it. Headline rewrites.
Extra, read all about it.
Headline rewrites.
Presented by Tila Mortgage.
The real story behind the headlines in today's news with Jake and Stacey.
All right, let's get things going here. The Pac-12 will be eliminating divisions in college football, and instead the two best teams in the conference will qualify for the title game.
Real headline, it opens up the field for who Oregon will play in 2022. Now, as a UW alum, I don't like this headline. It pains me. It hurts me. I don't like it, but let's be real. Let's be real. What all of us thought is, well, is Oregon going to play someone from the north or south? Mm. Like, is it still going to be north and south, or is it going to be, are you going to get a chance for, you know, for two north schools to come in here? Maybe you get two south schools. Maybe Lincoln Riley's looking at it saying, well, maybe it's going to be USC and,
I actually took this differently.
I'm trying to think of who from the south would actually.
Utah.
Oh, duh.
Yeah. I mean, I actually look at this and say, Oregon's got to earn it. Oregon actually has to earn it this time. New head coach, and you don't get the benefit of being in a weaker division, right? You have USC, you have Utah, who right now I think are the two. It's Utah, USC, and Oregon are the three best teams in the Pac-12 right now, and obviously Utah and USC would have been battling it out in the South, whereas Oregon would have been able to easily
take the
get
North.
Themselves in a position to win the North and get into the Pac-12 championship, where USC or Utah could have been the first or second best team and not be able to go to the Pac-12 championship. Overall, I think this is the right move for the Pac-12. Some people may not like it. Husky fans might not like it. Cook fans might not like it because it would have been an easier path for them to get to the Pac-12 championship, and I understand and get that completely. But in terms of the overall health, you want the very best teams, the very best product on the field when it comes to the Pac-12 championship and showcasing your two best teams in front of a national audience.
Are you saying the real headline should have been, which opens up the field for who Utah will play in 2022?
Yeah, actually I do. Because I really believe in this Utah team, and it's really going to come down to whether USC and Lincoln Riley can get this program up and running from year one. If not, I think it's going to be Oregon in Utah in the Pac-12 championship game. But obviously, it's going to be very interesting to watch how that unfolds here in the Pac-12. And you want to see the top really, really strengthen here. Because right now, the Pac-12 across the country isn't viewed very, very fondly at the moment, and that has to change.
Headline Rewrites.
During an event for local business leaders in Alabama, Nick Saban claimed that Texas A&M and Jimbo Fisher bought every player on their team using NIL deals during the 2022 recruiting season.
Real headline, said Saban to those business leaders, so try harder. Throw money like you've never thrown it before. I need you to put work into it.
Is that what we're missing here?
I think this is what I'm doing. Is Nick Saban coincidentally at a meeting with local business owners saying they bought all of their recruits and I need you to as well. We will facilitate it for you.
We can't do it like we used to do it.
We can't do it on our own.
We can't give money under the table like we used to
do it. We can't put these kids in a closed, locked room with money and tell them we're walking out.
Darn it.
We need your help.
Yep. Use your connections. Be out there. Be in the public eye. We got to compete with A&M now. We got to compete with Texas. We've got to compete with all of this big oil money that's out there right now. Honestly, I think this is one of the biggest jokes that we are witnessing at the current moment.
Why is
this
that,
feud
Jake?
Between Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher is just absolutely hilarious to me on so many levels. Number one, Nick Saban is mad at Jimbo Fisher and trying to downgrade his number one recruiting class because he said they bought every player. Like, they're not allowed to now with the NIL deals.
Well, also, like Nick Saban, a bastion of fair recruiting practices.
Yes, and the SEC has been doing dirty recruiting from the moment it birthed, okay? I mean, basically you are seeing a group of people where the concept of honor amongst thieves used to be so prevalent to now where NIL deals are out there and it's like, they're just going for each other's throats now.
Yeah.
And I think it's really rich. Then I think it's super rich that Jimbo Fisher is coming out against Nick Saban in a bunch of different ways, but also isn't denying the fact that they bought their players and that they were able to win a lot of recruiting battles because of the excellent NIL deals that they were able to put together for their players. And there's nothing wrong with that. He said, we did nothing illegal. Nick Saban he never said you did anything illegal. He just said you bought players. You put together bigger packages. And I would be annoyed if I'm Jimbo Fisher because on one end, yes, that is true. On the other end, we also put together a better recruiting pitch. Just because the kids also got more money and more compensation doesn't mean that they didn't like Texas A&M better for themselves or it downgrades what we're doing at A&M. So I think it just is all hilarious to me on so many levels, but it just two people yelling it in the wind, doing the same exact thing and saying that the other guy is wrong.
I actually really like Nick Saban. He's grown on me quite a bit, especially over the more recent years. However, it reminds me a little bit of the Urban Meyer thing where he was so used to having the upper hand with recruiting, not just with like where you're a god on campus, but with recruiting. You got your pick of five-star players.
Yeah.
They all wanted to go play for you. There was like four other schools you had to really compete with. And other than that, you got exactly who you wanted and they were flocking to your school. And then he he, being Urban Meyer, went to the NFL and for the very first time in his life dealt with any kind of parity and, for that matter, disadvantage. And he was like, what is this? What is this world I'm in? And he couldn't handle it. Now, I think that Nick Saban is not just a better man, but a better coach mm-hmm. than Urban Meyer. However, I think Nick Saban has been living in a world where he's had the upper hand with recruiting for how long? Years and years and years now. And he built that, right?
Over a decade.
He did that, but for the first time, you now have this really interesting dynamic with college football and college sports. We were talking about this earlier, where the environment in which you play, plays a factor, and there's a little more money with Texas schools.
There's no question.
Headline rewrites.
The Golden State Warriors beat the Dallas Mavericks in Game 1 of the Western Conference Finals.
Real headline, looks like Luka needs a few more McChickens and beers before Game 2 to keep this series competitive.
We were talking about this and joking around about it in the sports pit. And
to be 23 again.
Gosh, what it was like back then, right?
Now, this stems from a picture that came out of Luka drinking a beer at a restaurant. People thought it was, first of all, 10 a.m., but 10 a.m. the morning before the game. Luka said, no, that's an old photo. And then a local digital newspaper reached out to the restaurant, and the restaurant was like, oh, yeah, that was the afternoon before. So old photo, all pretty subjective, because turns out old was, it wasn't 8 hours before, you guys. It was 18 hours before.
Right.
Don't be ridiculous. All right, it's Jake and Stace. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710 and the Seattle Sports app. Mariners GM Jerry DePoto was on with Mike Salk this morning. We'll tell you everything he had to say next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union. You're listening.
All right, Jerry DePoto was on with Mike Salk earlier today for his usual Thursday interview and had plenty to say about Kyle Lewis, whether he's close to a return, Jared Kelnick, whether he can find his way back. Obviously, we know he can, but how that can happen when he thinks the offense can make a turn. So where do I get started? Let's start with Jared Kelnick, who obviously prior to the series against the Blue Jays and the Mets was the big story here, right? It was this guy that's supposed to be a cornerstone of your future is now being demoted. And while the Mariners have already said they don't really view it as punitive when they send someone down, especially for a young team, rather just developmental, he did say that too many people are doing one thing when it comes to Kelnick.
Yeah, I think too many people too quickly are writing Jared off. This is an opportunity for him to go find himself a little bit and in a little less stressful in an environment to perform. That's all.
So next he's asked, well, what do you want to see from Jared when he's with AAA Tacoma?
It's going to take time. You know, just go back to the minor leagues. It's going to be a performance-based thing over time, but it might not be the performance that the natural observer, you know, the fan in the stands might pick up on. It's pitch selection. It's what you're swinging at. It's how you go about your business. There is no question, you know, day to day, the work habits that Jared brings to the ballpark every day, and you've heard me say this before, they're awesome. Mm-hmm. He practices harder and more intensely than anybody else can. And I guess to some extent would like to see him, and this is going to sound absurd to say, try a little less hard.
It's not absurd to me at all. Like, I think that when you are of the mindset that Jared Kelnick has, and I think way too many people have tried to knock this guy down a peg or two because he's come in with incredible confidence. Why would you try to take that away from him? That's my genuine question. Why would you take that away from him? Is it to make you feel better? Because I want my athletes to feel extremely confident. Now, the problem is that Jared Kelnick came in and he did not perform to the level that he thought he could right out of the gate. And because of that, when you have someone that is that intense, you have someone that is that much of a worker who, you know, by all accounts, when you listen to him talk about, you know, his approach at the plate or talking through an at-bat, this is a very, you know, intelligent guy who understands the game, understands the process, yet it just seemed like he was overthinking everything. And then at one point in time, just trying to fight through the problem. Stacey, there's quarterbacks that I've worked with over the years where you teach them something different or they're struggling and they're failing at something and their natural inclination is to try harder. I'm going to force my way through the problem because I want it so bad that if I just try harder or I try to throw it harder or I try to do this or that, that it's going to get fixed. And that's not the right approach. It is to be able to absorb information, take it in, stay calm, cool, and collected, and go play and still have a lot of fun and be relaxed. And that's ultimately what Julio's been able to do. He's done a great job of doing that. And it's been very impressive to watch. Kelnick's natural inclination is to grip the bat tighter, to swing harder, and to try and, you know, pull everything when he's getting in that situation. Hunt fastballs, and if I can hit it really hard, then that's going to put me in good positions. And right now, he needs to learn to relax. He needs to learn to be able to have a calm, easy approach to his game. And, you know, I agree with Jerry DePoto that it will take time, and you don't want to rush trying to bring him back again. It's important for him to have this time.
He made sure to mention that Kelnick's still one of the younger guys in the league, and we aren't going to be able to get to it in this segment because I'm going to move on to some updates about Kyle Lewis and some of his thoughts on the offense. But I know that a lot of you are wondering, because I've seen these questions about whether or not the Mariners are going to make any trades and make any acquisitions. So one thing I did want to mention when talking about this team and the core of this team, Kelnick being part of that, specifically when it comes to the trade deadline, is Jerry DePoto is part of this interview. You can listen to it on the Mike Salk Show podcast. Was asked, hey, are you going to be, how do you know if you're going to be sellers or buyers? Like, what is it that tells you we're sellers or buyers this year? And Jerry DePoto said, the only way we're going to be complete sellers, the only way we are sellers, period, at the trade deadline is if we have lost faith in the core of this team and lost faith that the core and the nucleus of this team can win us a World Series. And we haven't done that yet. We still believe in this core. So that should also tell you how they feel about Jared Kelnick, who is a big part of that. That they still have faith in Kelnick, still have faith, obviously, in Julio Rodriguez, who's been phenomenal, especially of late, and still have faith in a lot of those young pieces.
How does it make you feel to hear Jerry DePoto talk about time, that Kelnick needs time down at the big leagues, in the minors? Does it frustrate you that he got brought up so quickly?
No.
Why?
Because DePoto said as part of this interview, we were giving it 30 days for a lot of these guys. Like, we weren't going to make a move to send anyone down or do anything until we were about a month in so we could see whether or not someone needed to stay. So I would wager that they were looking at Julio and a little bit at Kelnick, but probably thought that with Julio. Like, if Julio really struggles after a month, we'll bring him back down.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they didn't anticipate it would be Jared, but that certainly wasn't off the table. But I don't think that being sent back down is something the Mariners thought would be impossible with Jared. It's not anything to do with this one moment of sending someone down, which outside of someone like Mike Trout or some of those phenomenal young talents that are just otherworldly, rare, generational talents, like, that's going to happen with guys, especially young guys. But more of what it is like on a macro scale, right? On a macro step back, look at the team scale. I am increasingly impatient with the Mariners' quest to return to the playoffs. And yesterday I got into a conversation, not a debate, not a fight, just a conversation with someone on Twitter who was talking about the timeline when they should contend. And I get like a little frustrated with people who are like, calm down, it's May. Because my answer is like, well, it's May 2022. Last time this team was in the postseason, it was 20 years ago, you know, 21 years ago. So you might have wonderful memories of that. I don't.
Yeah.
I was a child. I would love for this team to get back to the postseason. And I recognize the pace at which baseball is played, and more importantly, the pace at which players improve over the course of the year. And I recognize that that's going to take much longer than today, May 19th, to really get a good look at what this team can be. And last year's World Series winner is a testament to that. However, it is impossible to rip the context of having the longest postseason drought from any kind of analysis of where the Mariners are. It is truly impossible to separate that context.
Well, I don't even think you need to even go back that far. I just listened to Jerry DePoto's comments, John Stanton, the owner of the Mariners' comments after the season of 2021, right? I mean, they put it upon themselves to say that they are ready to take the next step, that the expectations, that everything in which they are going about operating over the course of this offseason is to put them in position to compete for the playoffs, that they are out, they are basically out of this rebuild, and that now it's about winning games. that is what this organization has said. Scott Servais has said that and expressed that to us. And so that is what you are judging and basing them off of, Stacey. It's not your own expectations that are coming from left field or that are unfair because of the history that is of this Mariners organization. Just listen to their recent comments, right? I mean, that's as simple as it can be. And is this team in position to compete for the playoffs right now? Yes, it is May, but also you don't want to fall too far behind. And right now, anything can happen. The Angels can drop off. The Astros can certainly drop off. I don't expect the Astros to. The Angels are certainly a candidate to be boom or bust, that they got off to a great start and fall apart later on in the season. Certainly. But they are off to a very, very hot start, and they're looking like one of some of the best teams in baseball right now. So, and they're in your own division. So the margin for error at the current moment in time is not very wide. It's not very big. And so I think that when you're talking and judging this Mariners team, there's still plenty of time to go. But ultimately, things have to improve and have to get better for this offense in order for them to have a chance.
I've had a couple of people saying, no, Mike Trout was sent down. Mike Trout, I believe, was demoted just once in his career.
Correct? Yeah, and then the very next year, he...
That's what I'm saying.
He batted over 300 and was incredible.
I'm saying that even being demoted just once is rare. So I'm not panicking over Kelnick being sent down again or over any prospect kind of bouncing back and forth at the beginning of their career is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And
that even getting demoted once is not something that is altogether common.
And maybe last year, everyone got caught up in the hype of Kelnick, but also the Kevin Mather situation, right? If Kevin Mather had not, if that stuff had not been said, one, I'm glad it was because Kevin Mather's no longer, the president of the Mariners. And so that is a positive thing. But I would say that ultimately it is a situation where you look at Jared Kelnick and I just wish if you go back, you could have more time for him last year in the minor leagues before they brought him up, and that they brought him up at the end of last year rather than as early as they did.
Well, Jake, look what you did. You got us sidetracked. So now at 12:45, I'm going to have to get back to what Jerry DePoto had to say about Kyle Lewis, when they're going to make a decision, and as well as how he sees the offense evolving. So 12:45, I'll play those cuts for you guys. I promise we'll also probably have a bit more sound from DePoto by then, this interview, not very long ago. So we will get back to that at 12:45. First, though, my new favorite feud in sports. Like the most fun feud in sports that is about, 48 hours old or so. It's coming up next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered by Kitsap Credit Union.
All right, Texas A&M had the number one ranked recruiting class, and Nick Saban has an issue with it. In a meeting in front of local business people in Alabama, in fact, I don't know if he didn't realize he was being recorded, or maybe he didn't care at all that Jimbo Fisher would find any of this out and hear about it, but Nick Saban said at an event Wednesday night, A&M bought every player on their team. Now, by this, he's talking about names, images, and likenesses. Uh-huh. He said, they made a deal for name, image, and likeness. We didn't buy one player. I tried to say it with a Southern accent. I didn't have one. But I do know if we're going to be able to sustain that in the future because more and more people are doing it, it's tough. So before I continue, first of all, I'm explaining why this is the most fun new feud in college sports, in sports anywhere that you need to care about because of the mostly responses from Fisher that you're going to laugh about. Would you mind explaining, Jake, what Nick Saban is so upset about?
Well, what Nick Saban is upset about is, from his simple terms, is that Jimbo Fisher edged him out in recruiting. Their recruiting class at Texas A&M had the number one recruiting class this past year, and Alabama came in second. Now, Nick Saban is saying, look, the reason why Texas A&M was able to do this is because they were able to pay their players more than we were. Simple as that, cut and dry. There's no other reason.
People or businesses, third parties around the school, not the school.
Correct. Whoever. Yes. But in implication is that the school did it, and that the school did stuff that was, I mean, essentially, he was basically calling it a farce. That this was not because A&M is such a great school, or because their program is good, or that Jimbo Fisher's a good head coach. It was just simply because they were able to pay their players more. And Jimbo Fisher took major exception to that. Now, Nick Saban didn't say they did anything illegal. He never used those words, but that's how Jimbo Fisher took Nick Saban's comments, because for years and years and years, you have not been able to pay players, right? The very concept of paying players has been illegal, and so it results in suspensions and fines and wins being taken away, all those types of things. And so Jimbo Fisher has this press conference today, mad at Nick Saban, saying we didn't do anything illegal. There were no violations here at Texas A&M, which is hilarious to me because Nick Saban never said any of that. Let's go to cut number four and listen to Jimbo Fisher here in his press conference today.
And our fans, I apologize to you guys for people saying those things about Texas A&M. I promise you this, there are no violations. There are nothing wrong. It's the second time we've had to do this with grown men.
It's funny to me. It's funny because he's dancing around this. This is, and Jimbo Fisher never denied that they never paid players. Of course you did. It's the new way of doing things now. The NIL has opened this up, and you guys are one of the most aggressive universities that is out there in terms of giving, you know, major NIL packages to recruits. It's hilarious to me. And Jimbo Fisher also went off on Nick Saban in a lot of ways. Let's start here with cut number one here. Jimbo Fisher talking about Nick Saban and being a god.
It's amazing. Some people think they're God. Go dig into how God did his deal. You may find out about a guy that a lot of things you don't want to know. We built him up to be the czar of football. Go dig into his past or anybody that's ever coached with him. You can find out anything you want to find out, what he does and how he does it. And it's despicable.
I am here for this feud because you like, spill it, Jimbo.
You
tell
like
us
that?
Everything
exactly.
Nick Saban did.
Hey, you were also an offensive coordinator. You're talking about asking any of these coaches. No, I want to ask you. I want to ask you right now.
I would love for you to tell us how Nick Saban made Alabama the best program in college
football. It didn't stop there. Let's go to cut number two. Cut number two.
First of all, I'll say it's a shame that we have to do this. It's really despicable. It's despicable that somebody can say things about somebody and an organization. More importantly, 17-year-old kids. You're taking shots at 17-year-old kids and their families. And they broke state laws. They're all money. We bought every player on this group. We never bought anybody. No rules were broken. Nothing was done wrong. It was all in the way we do things, the ethics in which we do things. And these families, it's despicable that a reputable head coach could come out and say this when he doesn't get his way or things don't go his way. The narcissist in him doesn't allow those things to happen, and it's ridiculous.
Again, Nick Saban didn't call out the 17-year-old kids. He didn't call out the families. He didn't say that you guys did anything illegal. He said that you paid the players. And I don't like the comment. I don't think that is – I agree with Jimbo Fisher that it's annoying that Nick Saban is saying those things and acting like that is the only reason why they lost out on some of the recruits, and that Nick Saban hasn't been doing this for years, that he hasn't been the one that's participated in illegal activities over the years. The entire SEC has. But it is such a tone-deaf argument between two people that are dominating college football right now in the recruiting sphere, and it just goes to talk about how the landscape of recruiting has changed so much.
See, that's why the feud is particularly interesting to me, is because it reflects that the power balance in the landscape of recruiting, specifically with where that persuasion and that money comes from, has gone from purely within the school's power now you have a little outside influence there, and all of a sudden that changes, especially geographically, where the powerhouse schools are coming from. And Alabama has a little less power compared to those Texas schools, those California schools. So we'll see how all of that continues to evolve. Again, we'll probably get back to this a little bit later. We're certainly getting back to that Jerry DePoto.
Oh yeah, and we're going to talk. And by the way, we're talking to Bruce Feldman at 1 o'clock about this. So
yes, good point. We're talking with Bruce Feldman about this. We're also going to get into college football as a whole. But first, we are going to bring on Andy McKay to talk about the Mariners' core, specifically with when we might see Kyle Lewis back and Jared Kelnick. Don't go anywhere.